From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy.
The best way for people to get a better way of life is the unions. You need the health benefits. You need a good, decent salary. The 40-hour work week. We did not get it by voting. We got it by the protests, which you guys are doing.
With a workers' movement growing throughout the country, we hear from healthcare workers, union members, and other frontline workers about their struggle for survival.
I understand there's reason to be concerned or to not trust healthcare, and that is something we in healthcare have to earn back.
We hear from nurse Yvette Cheeks, who manages a busy vaccination clinic in the suburbs of Houston, Texas.
To have our own vaccine takes us from what you call the monopoly, that's really a monopoly. And we say that we are being independent of the world market.
And we learn about what the island nation of Cuba is doing to protect its people from COVID and to offer solutions to other nations, even as the United States continues to impose a deadly blockade on its people. This and more in this week's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Johanna Fernandez. In January 2021, for the first time in 35 years, 1,400 workers at the Hunts Point produce market in the Bronx struck for almost the week. The strikers are essential workers who distribute 60% of New York City's fruits and vegetables to supermarkets and restaurants. They are members of Teamsters Local 202, and they voted to go on strike on midnight Sunday, January 17th, after talks over an hourly raise disintegrated.
The essential workers at Hunts Point are not being treated fairly. We're going to be out here. If the things don't change, we'll be out here on strike next week.
To afford to live in this city, especially in the five boroughs, on our wage for what we do, it's not amicable.
I argue a dollar increase should be the floor and not the ceiling.
Nearly a dozen New York congressional Democrats, led by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, visited the picket line.
There are workers, food workers in every pocket of the United States who deserve more than $1, who deserve more than a raise. They deserve health care. They deserve justice. They deserve good worker rights.
The lawmakers demanded federal mediators investigate abuse by law enforcement at the strike, including the arrest of five workers at the picket line when 300 NYPD cops in riot gear clashed with strikers. On the morning of Friday, January 22nd, we interviewed Leo Servidio, vice president of Teamsters Local 202, who worked in the Hunts Point market for 36 years. He spoke to us from the picket line at Hunts Point.
I've been here. I've been home only once to see my family and a quick shower and a quick nap. But other than that, I've been sleeping in my car in our Mobile Command Center, never leaving this place because I wanted the people to know that I would never abandon them and they would never abandon me in our struggle for what's right.
Can you tell us a bit more about the run-up to the strike?
What happened was during the negotiation process, which was approximately 6 weeks, and we went back and forth with different proposals. When we finally hit the part that needed to be discussed more, we talked about wages. And the employer came at us with an unforgivable wage package of 32 cents an hour. Now, we've just come off a pandemic, which still exists. COVID-19 is still rampant. And we lost six members inside the Hunts Point market that died of COVID. And we partnered with them during the epidemic so this way there wouldn't be a food shortage here in New York City, in New York State, in the metropolitan area. And we did what was right. We came to work, bundled up, we did what's right. We unloaded trucks. We made sure everybody had fresh food. And if you remember, there was paper towel and toilet paper shortages, but there was never a shortage of fresh fruits and vegetables. When it was time for them to do what's right for the essential worker, they took advantage. So we became essential, and then we became non-essential when it came time to pay. We unanimously rejected that offer by a vote margin of 398-45. We then went on strike. It was cold. We're out there in the street every day. Fortunately, yesterday, at approximately 11:45 a.m., they called us up and they told us they want us to go back to the table. So that's where we are right now. We're still negotiating to see if we can get a fair contract and a fair resolution in this. If not, then we will continue our strike for the struggle of the American worker here in the Latino community in the South Bronx. We're in the poorest congressional district in the United States, which is the Hunts Point section of the Bronx. Most of the jobs, most of the people hired here live in the South Bronx and in the Bronx in general. They pack boxes, they work in the cold, they work in the heat, they work in the snow, they work in the sleet. La mayorita, the Latino, you know, the majority of them are Latino people that come here to go to work.
And the workers won. On Saturday, January 23rd, workers approved a new 3-year contract that will net them a raise. Some 97% of the workers voted in favor of the contract that will increase their wages by $1.85 per hour over the next 3 years. In the first year, the raise is 70 cents an hour, the second year, 50 cents an hour, and the third year, 65 cents an hour. The agreement also includes a 40 cents per hour contribution to employee health care. Let's listen to Anthony Rosa, a 30-year member and secretary treasurer of the Teamsters Local 202, followed by its president, Daniel Kane Jr., speaking after the win.
I want to thank the community, and I definitely want to thank the warriors, the people that stood outside on the line. I love you. I will walk the walk with you anytime again.
All of our members out there, give a shout out to those folks who've been out here this whole time. They have been on the front lines and now, today, ratified a new collective bargaining agreement. And these folks did that. And I'm hoping that that will resonate with workers throughout this country, because our members are essential and decent, hardworking family people, but there are millions of people who fit that description in this country. And for too long, they have not been listened to. They have been forgotten. And I think that our country better start paying attention to them, because they do have power if they stand shoulder to shoulder. They do count if they stand with each other in solidarity. Regular hardworking people can do miracles.
This strike is part of a national trend. 2019 witnessed an increase in major work stoppages, the highest increase in 25 years. Meanwhile, the challenges posed by COVID-19 pushed many workers to strike or engage in workplace protests or sick outs. Unions report a surge in workers taking action during 2020 and an increased interest in organizing. Grocery stores, warehouses, hospitals, nursing homes, fast food restaurants, schools, and health clinics, unionized and not, all saw walkouts in 2020. Why? Under pandemic, many essential workers did not think it acceptable that they earned low wages and that they lacked access to paid sick leave or compensation, despite working under hazardous conditions. Back in 2020, we reported on the women who work at Wash Supply Laundry in Manhattan. The women were protesting working conditions and were organizing a union drive. This is Yuriana, one of the workers during those protests back in December.
My name is Yuriana. I have worked in this laundry for many years, and today I raise my voice along with my co-workers who are tired of being exploited day after day. We demand to be recognized as essential workers. They have not provided us with the safety equipment we need during this pandemic. They have discriminated against us. And on this day, we want to raise our voices for all those women who work in laundries in the city.
In retaliation, Yuriana was fired last week, only days before the vote to unionize. But last Friday, January 29th, these laundry workers voted almost unanimously to form a union. Meanwhile, many employers of essential workers, including Walmart, Amazon, Kroger, and Costco, raked in record profits. 13 of the largest retail companies in the country earned a total of $16.7 billion more in 2020 than they did in 2019, while raising workers' pay an average of just $1.11 per hour since the start of the pandemic. 2020 brought something else with it. In 2020, the rate of unionization increased in the United States for the first time in over a decade. This according to data released by the Bureau of Labor Statistics on January 22nd of this year. 10.8% of American workers belonged to a union in 2020, up from 10.3% in 2019. Why? Amidst mass job loss during the pandemic, workers belonging to a union saw fewer job losses than non-union workers. What does this all mean? The political picture we're seeing is mixed. Neo-Nazi organizing is on the rise. But so is strike activity and workplace actions. We'll remind you that BLM protests brought out between 35 and 40 million Americans into the streets in 2020. So where do we go from here? We asked listeners during our interview with Leo Servideo last Friday, and here are some of their answers. Let's listen to Charles from the Bronx, followed by Joe, a former New York City transit worker.
The power is not really in the vote, it's really in the organizing and the protesting, which people do have the power. Capitalism is an evil system, and we got to fight it. And the best way for people to get a better way of life is the unions, because you can't live on a salary alone. You need the benefits, you need the health benefits, you need a good, decent salary. The 40-hour work week. We did not get it by voting. We got it by the protests, which you guys are doing. Your protest is very powerful.
I'm a former transit worker, and we shut the city down for 11 days in 1964 and won. The capitalist dictatorship we're living in, their first budget priority is police to break strikes. Teamsters feed the city. We need to organize with transit, hospitals, sanitation, service, and delivery workers, and the general public, and to working class that can run society in the interest of everyone.
This segment was produced by Marcos Maldonado Cruz.
I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he. In Salt Lake City, Joe says I am standing by my bed. They framed you on a murder charge, says Joe, but I'm dead. Says Joe, but I'm dead.
California, and particularly Los Angeles, is ground zero for the COVID pandemic. And yet, after a year, healthcare workers are still not getting enough gowns, masks, or PPEs. We hear from Sandy Redding, president of the California Nurses Association and a vice president with the National Nurses Union. We also hear from Sal Roselli, president of the National Union of Healthcare Workers. They spoke to producer Steve Seltzer about profiteering in the healthcare industry and the need for Medicare for all.
What we're doing is, first, you know, we've launched a petition asking Gavin Newsom to apply for the necessary federal waivers to allow California to pursue single-payer type program, Medicare for All, here in our state, and believe that within a few years, we can accomplish it here, and California can be the example for the rest of the country. Getting universal health access, you know, to quality health care. And believe that eventually, whether we can accomplish legislation or a legislative program or not, it will go on the ballot before Californians. Because even if we did succeed in a legislative program, the industry would repeal of it on the ballot. So the bottom line is we need to organize and educate California voters about the value of it, and deeply educate folks so they can withstand the campaign of, you know, $100 million plus that the industry would spend to repeal it. You know, when the pandemic began in March, the industry had evolved to what we describe as just-in-time inventory, just-in-time staffing, just-in-time PPE, just-in-time equipment to deal with normal situations. So no hospital, no healthcare plan was ready for this pandemic, and in fact is not ready for it today.
When you have just-in-time staffing or just-in-time ordering of supplies, you're going to run short, and it's just not a good way. It's not a good model for the healthcare industry. The model is, you know, we need to make sure that we have the supplies that we need so that we can be prepared for things such as a pandemic and give the nurses the necessary protections that we need. You don't see firefighters going into a burning building without their necessary protection, and we should have the same protections that we require to do the job for infection control purposes, to prevent the spread, to preserve life, and to make sure that nurses have the proper protection so that we can be there for our patients instead of getting sick. There are, like you said, so many nurses that are getting sick and other healthcare workers that are getting sick, and it's just continuing to cycle because we don't have adequate personal protective equipment. It's a year into this thing. We should have had it. Previous administration should have, the president should have invoked the Defense Production Act so that we could have had ramping up of the supplies of PPE that we need so that we could curb the spread and save more lives, protect our patients, and make sure nurses are protected at the bedside so we're there when you need us.
Are your members still fighting for PPE and protection on the job?
Absolutely. If one of our nurses pre-pandemic walked away from a patient, a pulmonary patient that she was treating, and did not dispose of her N95 mask, she would be fired. Today, N95 masks, there's not only a shortage of supply, they have to be used over and over again. You know, we just have horrendous stories on that front.
We're having to continue to reuse masks, okay, and N95. You know, Medicare for All is the solution. That's what we believe is the solution. We've seen it in other countries, and California Nurses Association, National Nurses United has met through Global Nurses United, and we've discussed these things with nurses throughout the globe. And the issues are the same, but the outcomes are better in those places that have universal health care, Medicare for All system.
Our health care system is fundamentally flawed and needs major overhaul. You know, we need to take for-profit out of health care and adopt a single-payer Medicare for All type of system.
Yvette Cheeks, a registered nurse managing a busy vaccination clinic in the suburbs of Houston, Texas, speaks to KPFT's Akua Holt about her experience as a frontline essential worker administering the vaccine at the height of the COVID-19 pandemic.
Tell us how long you've been in your occupation. Talk to us about some of the challenges that you're seeing.
Thank you for having me today. I've been in nursing since 1987. I've been in the immunology specialty since 2008, and some of the challenges that we're seeing, partially knowledge base for our clients and the public, they have a lot of concerns as far as who to trust and where to get their information from, and being careful about misinformation. Secondly, we're having difficulty from a political and economic side with the infrastructure and support to get the immunizations from the refrigerator into arms.
Are you seeing a peak in patients?
Certainly so. We got 500 doses originally on December 23rd. Best Christmas gift you could ever imagine, besides the reason why Christmas exists. And we got those 500 doses into arms in short order and have been unable to obtain anything else for new doses. But we have obtained the second doses. So we are currently immunizing our second doses for our original 500. That's where we are. We're almost through with that and have no idea if and when we are getting more. That's quite challenging for our patients. We get about 300 calls a day according to our call history. We can't even answer the phone. It just goes straight to voicemail. We have no abilities to manage that kind of volume. So we have a wait list of about 287 healthcare providers, about 130 high risk, and then about 100 in the essential personnel, which we're talking about still 1A and 1B, which is what we're approved to do at this time for the state. And we've stopped our waiting list.
What are you hearing from the patients? What are they saying?
A lot of frustration about the registration process, the lack of information, the lack of structure. It feels like a survival series, like throw it out and you just, whoever gets to the phone fastest gets it first type of situation. There's just not enough support and infrastructure going on. Even though we did a lot of what we call micro planning at the state level, even before the vaccine was approved, there's a lot of broken pieces, a lot of structural issues and defects. And as you would imagine, from websites crashing to problems with the intake processes, and again, just the sheer volume of people in need and not having enough of what you need to go around. I thought originally that the problem was the holidays, that things would get better, we would get more structure, we would get more support after everybody in the government world came back from the holidays, but that has unfortunately not been the case. So it's a lot of frustration.
Mask or no mask, are your clients saying that they believe in masks? And because we have so many people in America who are saying, what virus? There's no need to wear a mask. It's a hoax.
Surely you have those, but that's not who we are getting calls from. The people that we're getting know it's happening. They've seen people, they know people that are sick or have died. And they definitely are masking. I think the only frustration with the masking, it's difficult to wear it over your nose constantly. I realized pretty quickly that first week why I'm not a surgical nurse. It's difficult even for me. I sometimes feel like I gotta take a breath outside of the mask, but definitely masking is the way to go. And we do our teaching with our patients that even after a vaccine, you must mask because the vaccine keeps you from getting severe COVID, which means you won't be sick. We have had cases where people have had asymptomatic COVID, so they can still spread it to someone else. They just don't get sick themselves. So as we vaccinate more people, we should see the stress off the hospitals abate. We should see the stress off our staff at the hospitals get lower, and those kind of things that will make a difference in getting our economy back to work. It will not make the fact that you have asymptomatic COVID go away. So we still got to wear those masks.
Let's talk a little bit about active and passive immunity. Help us understand the difference.
So first of all, what is a vaccine? A vaccine stimulates your immune system to produce antibodies, exactly like if you were exposed to the disease. So when you get the disease, that is passive immunity. When you get the vaccines, we've activated your immunity. That's active immunity. And active immunity is better. For one thing, you don't get the side effects. You don't end up in the hospital when we're talking about something like COVID. But you also, the immunity lasts longer. When you have chickenpox, that is passive immunity. And you can get chickenpox again because it doesn't last forever. But the chickenpox vaccine takes your immunity up so high that you won't get chickenpox again. So that's the difference. And we want to activate your immune system with these new mRNA vaccines. And I know those are scary, but it is really not. It's a wonderful technology. It is not new. It has been studied for over 10 years. And I believe the science. I think they are safe. We have 9 months of data that they're safe. They're definitely effective. And we're not seeing any problems with anything. People are having babies without issues. We, are going to follow the data. And some things we won't know until time passes. I think more than anything, we're the product of our success. If anyone around would ask their parents and grandparents, do they know somebody in school that had polio? Do they know somebody that ended up in a sanatorium for TB? Did they know somebody that died with measles or is deaf? They would be shocked at how much that they don't know about even their own family history. I shared this with someone and she called me back and she says, I didn't know I had a brother. They never told me. He died when he was less than 2 years old from meningitis before we had a meningitis vaccine. So we've been so successful. People say, I've never heard of this disease because we have vaccines that prevent it. We've been doing this for a long time. This is not new. I understand there's reason to be concerned or to not trust healthcare, and that is something we in healthcare have to earn back.
You're listening to Yvette Cheeks. She's an RN, MSN. And she is a native of Houston. And she's also the director of an immunization clinic in Safford, Texas, which is a suburb of Houston. Yvette, can you help us before you close? We need to understand this mRNA technology. Can you help us sort of dissect this in layman's terms?
So the M stands for messenger. Like all vaccines, the mRNA vaccines were tested rigorously for safety before they were authorized even for emergency use. Even though the technology is new, it is not unknown and has been studied for decades. They do not contain live viruses. So at any point, there's not even a diluted form of COVID in this vaccine. All right. So it carries no risk of carrying the disease itself to the person that's being vaccinated. It never enters the nucleus of the cell and does not affect or interact with your own DNA. So although this is a new approach to vaccines, and they took this innovative route to help us do this quickly, you wonder, how did they do this so fast? Because they basically cloned the DNA of the virus, and they gave us this clone to activate our immunity so it would recognize the COVID virus if we were exposed and then respond appropriately. And your immune system would say, oh, I know how to deal with this. Most vaccines in the past have used a weakened or inactivated version of the disease to stimulate that immune response. And this one is totally different. We do not have to give you the disease itself. So I'm excited about it. I think it's going to be a lot of new breakthrough treatments, maybe for cancer and other problems that we can do this with. We're the backbone of America, and always have been, that we should be protecting ourselves because no one else is going to do that. And can I tell you, those people that are saying they wouldn't wear a mask and they didn't believe in the disease, they're begging for the vaccine. They're in line. So we've got to do it. We got to do it for our families, for our communities, to be able to get back to work economically, to be able to thrive again. This is one of the steps towards getting that, and you don't want to be shut out.
Yvette, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me. My name is Yvette Cheeks. I'm a registered nurse with a Master's of Science in Nursing. I'm a native Houstonian, wife of a pastor. We've been in the Houston area. I went to HISD schools, Houston Community College, UTMB, and Western Governors for my degrees. And I have 2 children and 5 grandchildren, and I live in a multi-generational home.
Oh, mama, mama, look there. Your children are playing in the street again. Don't you know what happened down there? A youth of 14 got shot down there. The cocaine guns are jammed downtown. The killing clowns are blood money men. Shooting those Washington bullets again. Every cell in Chile will tell the cries of the tortured men. Remember Allende and the days before the army came. Please remember Victor Jara in the Santiago Stadium. Es verdad, those Washington bullets again. And in the Bay of Pigs in 1961, Havana for the playboy in the Cuban sun. For Castro is the color is a redder than red. Those Washington bullets want Castro dead. For Castro is the color, double a new spray of lead.
One country, only 90 miles from the U.S. southern coastline, has been able to contain the coronavirus despite a massive U.S. blockade. We're talking about Cuba, which despite suffering under unilateral coercive actions, aka sanctions imposed by the U.S. and its NATO allies, has had better health outcomes amidst the pandemic than its not-so-friendly neighbor to the north. KPFK's Polina Vasiliev spoke to University of Havana pediatric gastroenterologist Dr. Eduardo Sagaro.
But what I want to say with this is a deep concern about the severe impact of unilateral coercive measures on the dramatic consequences of this crisis, specifically to countries where the populations already endures difficult living conditions due to different causes, such as these coercive measures. And we urge the immediate lifting of all unilateral coercive measures against Cuba. That's a country that's playing a critical role to stop the pandemic, not only in the island, but also helping other countries abroad in different continents, from Europe to Latin America, to Africa and to Asian countries. But even though that was happening, at the same time, we have a medical care system for all our citizens, with 9 doctors for every 1,000 inhabitants. Our medical system covers 100% of the population. And we also have developed a biotechnological and pharmaceutical industry with novel products for the treatment of the COVID-19, such as alpha-2B interferon, CIGB-258 peptide, and others. These novel drugs improve the immunity and control the inflammations of the lungs. That's the scenery. But how are things now? In nearly a year, in Cuba, there has been 21,828 cases. Of this, 3,486 have been admitted to hospitals. At the very first beginning of this, our approach to the epidemic was different. We admitted to the hospitals every patient that had COVID-19 to start treating them with this drug that I was telling you in order to have a prompt response against the pandemic. And of these 21,828 cases, 17,034 were recovered, and only 197 patients died. On January 28th, that's yesterday, we had in the island 666 new cases that were diagnosed after being done 14,593 tests. Of this, yesterday, 4 patients died, 725 patients were dismissed from the hospitals. There we had 41 patients in intensive care unit. Those were 14 in a critical state. And of those 666 new cases, 72 were children. Today, the situation is similar. And this has been one of the highest peaks of the epidemic here in Cuba. Today, we had 659 new cases. And there were done 13,903 samples of tests. Only 2 people died, and 563 patients were dismissed from the hospitals. The provinces with the biggest incidents were Guantanamo, La Habana, Santiago de Cuba, and Matanzas. That's the situation of the epidemic here at the moment. As you see, it's our highest peak, but nevertheless, our mortality rate is one of the lowest, is lower than the mean in the world and lower than the mean in the American continent. We have a low mortality rate compared with other countries. You spoke about the monopoly of the vaccines. And I'm going to say maybe things that have not been said by the media in the United States. Because the only third world country that has developed vaccines against this SARS-CoV-2 epidemic is Cuba. And we have 4 candidates that have been made by our own scientific research institutes that were all gathered in chain to do this. There were 4 candidates, Soberana 1, Soberana 2, Abdala, and Mambisa. Well, some have been developed by the National Vaccine Production Center. Some other has been done by the Center of Genetic Engineering and Biotechnology. Some with institutes similar to that in Havana, but that were in Santiago de Cuba. But the purpose of everybody was of cooperation. The universities, all the research centers, all our scientific potential was dedicated to this, and we have succeeded. And now we have the plan to, these vaccines are in phase two of research. And by the month that will be in March, I cannot say at the beginning or at the end of March, there's the plan to produce in all the center or the vaccine that has been accepted. I think that the most probably would be Soberana, one of the Soberana, to develop and deliver 100 million doses of vaccines. I read systematically the New England Journal of Medicine. They speak about vaccines, but they never speak of our vaccines. They only speak about Moderna, Pfizer, the European one, but no one mentioned the Cuban vaccine. And this is very important because first they are silencing it, but later on they will try to discredit it. And we have this, to have our own vaccine saves us from what you call the monopoly. That's really a monopoly. And we say that we are being independent of the world market and that the companies. The big companies that have this is first of all to admit this is to admit that this is a big success of the Cuban and the science and health system, and they are not interested in showing that to the public of the United States. Maybe you have a breaking news of what's happening here, because I haven't read it in the Guardian of London or in the New York Times or in the New England Journal of Medicine, anything about our vaccines.
Nope.
It simply don't exist for them. And you say, why, if we have a population of 10 or 11 million and our purpose is to deliver this, to give it freely to every Cuban, freely to everybody here from one point of the island to the other point of the island, to give it to everybody. But there are more vaccines than the one that we really need. And this is dedicated to be delivered to several countries. As far as I know, and it has been published before, Iran, Pakistan, India, Nicaragua, Venezuela, as a way to break that monopoly. And this has been testing. It's a polyclinic near here. Now they're testing it there. They're making the phase two research. But in March, it is said that we will start vaccinating everybody. And we don't have to depend on if a ship wants to come here, or the ship has the flag of the United States, or the Moderna has a big price, or Pfizer doesn't want to give it to us. I tell you, the problem is to serve the people, to help the people, to avoid the disease, to stop people dying of this terrible disease. And maybe the amino acids or the specific protein that is created, the vaccines, can cover it. I don't know. I know that there are some of these vaccines that are only the vaccines, and are other vaccines that are potentiated by anti-tetanic toxoid to make it the immune response bigger. That's what I know. I am only a clinician. I am not a medical, biomedical engineering, or not. I can tell you what I know, and that's the problem. I hope that at the end of this year, maybe not only us, but I think that the new government of the United States is taking very seriously this problem. It seems to me from abroad.
Big tech censorship is an increasing concern on both the left and the right. Social media giants have suspended accounts, and Amazon has refused to distribute books it somehow deems dangerous, including the title, Capitalism on a Ventilator, The Impact of COVID-19 in China and the U.S., Pacifica's Anne Garrison reports.
Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, and other prominent social media platforms suspended Donald Trump's accounts after the Capitol riot. Twitter also suspended 70,000 accounts that it said were linked to the QAnon conspiracy theory. Earlier this week, the World Socialist website reported that Facebook, without explanation, carried out a purge of left-wing, anti-war, and progressive pages and accounts, including those of leading members of the Socialist Equality Party. Social media giants are often accused of censorship, but Amazon also censors. This week, Popular Resistance streamed a YouTube panel to promote Capitalism on a Ventilator, The Impact of COVID-19 in China and the U.S., an anthology that Amazon has refused to distribute. The book is a project of the International Action Center and the U.S.-China Solidarity Network, co-edited by Sarah Flounders and Li Xiuhin. Here's Sarah Flounders introducing the streaming panel, which is now archived on the Popular Resistance YouTube channel.
Welcome. I'm so glad you've joined us for tonight's webinar, COVID-19, How Weaponizing Disease and Vaccine Wars Are Failing Us. I'm Sarah Flounders, an editor and one of the 50 co-authors of Capitalism on a Ventilator, The Impact of COVID-19 in China and the U.S. It's published by International Action Center and the China-U.S. Solidarity Network. And I'm joined tonight by a great panel of some really important co-authors of Capitalism on a Ventilator. My co-editor, Li Xiuhin of the China-U.S. Solidarity Network, is here speaking to us from Shanghai. And four of the authors of some significant chapters are joining this panel. Margaret Flowers, a doctor and pediatrician, co-founder with the much-missed Kevin Zeese of Popular Resistance, is here. And we're also joined by Margaret Kimberly of Black Agenda Report, Black Alliance for Peace, a senior editor of Black Agenda Report, by Vijay Prashad, the director of Tricontinental Institute for Social Research, and by Max Blumenthal, the co-founder and editor of Gray Zone. So these are really tremendous reporters, journalists, writers, activists that I'm sure many of you are already well familiar with. We wanted to meet after the new Biden administration to evaluate where we're at, evaluate the new vaccine distribution, what it means in the U.S. and the world.
In its notice to the authors and publisher, Amazon said, quote, "Due to the rapidly changing nature of information around coronavirus, we are referring customers to official sources for advice about the prevention or treatment of the virus. Amazon reserves the right to determine what content we offer according to our content guidelines. Your book does not comply with our guidelines. As a result, we are not offering your book for sale." Unquote. For Pacifica, I'm Ann Garrison.
Tech giants are censoring online educational activities for those who are critical of the Israeli occupation of Palestine. San Francisco State University professors Rabab Abdulhadi and Tomomi Kinakawa spoke to COVID Race and Democracy about the censorship by Zoom, Facebook, and YouTube of an international panel called Whose Narratives? Gender, Justice, and Resistance, a conversation with Leila Khaled.
Dr. Kinakawa and I have organized a two-part series on gender and sexual justice in Arab and Muslim communities, focusing on Palestine for fall 2020, given the fact that we, as a result of COVID-19 pandemic, we were all instructed to shelter in place and do all our courses and all our instruction online. We had already in spring 2020 come together and did a couple of series, two-part series, also on gender and sexual in Palestine in particular. And that was really, and it was the initiative of Dr. Kinakawa, was very successful. So we thought, why not actually do something in the fall? And then we thought, if we're going to be doing it anyway, why only have readings and have me speak and Dr. Kinakawa as a guest speaker? Why can't we actually get the people about whom we're studying online to actually have them in person to talk to the students? Which we thought this would be a huge treat for San Francisco State students. And then what happened is the Zionist groups basically mobilized themselves in order for them to silence again, once again, narratives on Palestinian resistance, narratives on resistance, and then on silence it completely. So they mobilized, they pressured Zoom, they pressured other media groups and so on. It was, by the way, it was really the Israeli government was also involved day in and day out. So we're not talking about the cottage industry. They got involved and basically pressured in order to silence it. Unfortunately, our own university issued a statement about academic freedom, but then after we were silenced by Zoom, did not provide us an alternative platform.
Dr. Tomomi Kinakawa?
Before the webinar, like in early September, the Zionist law firm, Lawfare Project, contacted both Zoom and also the Department of Justice, claiming that our webinar is violating the anti-terrorist law, and they claim that it's an unlawful provision of material support to designated foreign terrorist organizations, and then they pressured both Zoom and SCSU to cancel the webinar, and then eventually Zoom canceled it. And the university, although the university administration did say that they support academic freedom and they don't cancel the webinar. However, they also didn't support us to actually hold the webinar. And instead, they emailed us to tell us that the university supports academic freedom, but there is a limit. And then when there is a violation of laws involved, and they said that individuals and organizations told them that there is a chance that our webinar might be violating those laws.
What are the conditions of Palestinians during COVID and the occupation by Israel?
Yes, it's true. Actually, the first thing is that Israel has actually denied access to vaccines around COVID to Palestinians. It is very clear, and this is not the first time. If we remember, we don't have to go back in history too much, but if we remember, in 1991, during the one of the Gulf Wars, when the U.S. was trying to was attacking Iraq, actually the Palestinians were denied masks or chemical war attack. Palestinians in Jerusalem, Palestinians who have Israeli citizenship. So this is continued and continues with the prisoners as well, who are actually infected by COVID.
Are the censorship by these tech companies a threat to democracy and freedom of speech in the United States?
Of course it is, because if you actually have, if tech companies, private tech companies like Zoom, is allowed to have veto power on the content of our classroom, who's going to be safe? So you might think now, oh, just about Palestine and exceptionalized Palestine and so on. But it's going to be on everything because they established a precedent. This is what happened in 1986 when the LA 8 was attacked in Los Angeles. The Palestinians LA 8 were attacked. The Reagan administration at the time intended to use that as, quote-unquote, the weakest thing in order to actually pass registration against everybody. And true enough, post 9/11/2001, Patriot Act 1 and Patriot Act 2 ended up building on a lot of the building blocks of the attack on the LA 8, which, by the way, not only Reagan, but President Reagan was also against it in order to attack the Palestinians as well as the Central America, because, they were very much involved with the Red Squad and the Iran-Contra affair and whatever. But also his vice president, George Herbert Bush, was the author of a plan called Terrorist Aliens Undesirables. And it actually built, and this is where actually like also myself and Dr. Kinakawa intersect, because they had a plan for constructing camps, incarceration camps, the way they did, the U.S. government did for the Japanese people during World War II, in order to incarcerate Arab people from Arab and Muslim countries and put them there because they constructed them as alien terrorists. So this is not something new. They continue doing it again and again and again. The question is, what does something like the administration of San Francisco State have to say about the vilification of Palestinians, Arabs, and Muslims, and other people of color, what does it have to say about actually contributing to this kind of narrative? When the university president goes and attends and speaks at a Zionist rally that's co-organized by the Israeli consulate, the Israeli government, by Hillel, by the Anti-Defamation League, and other people and so on, that intends to vilify anything about Palestinian narrative and Palestinian narratives of resistance. This really speaks to the connections between the people who are exercising repression and those who are claiming to be liberal, but they're not really, you know, because they're actually perpetuating this, and people who have historically suffered, like Japanese people, like comfort women, like other people who have suffered again and again and again. And what is the role of the university leadership in perpetuating or resisting some of these repressive narratives? How do we teach our students?
Prisoners face the brunt of this pandemic. Malik Washington is a prisoner who is serving part of his time in a federal halfway house run by the for-profit prisons corporation, GEO Group. Malik is also editor of the San Francisco Bay View, a national newspaper. After another newspaper reported on a COVID outbreak in the facility where Malik is housed, it was assumed that he tipped the reporter. In retaliation, the facility confiscated Malik's cell phone, and this has prevented him from doing his job as editor. Nube Brown, managing editor of the San Francisco Bay View and host of Prison Radio, spoke about Malik's case.
I am honored to be able to represent the San Francisco Bay View National Black Newspaper, as well as California Prison Focus. Both of those, the San Francisco Bay View obviously publishes a newspaper every month, and California Prison Focus also publishes a newspaper, Prison Focus, which comes out quarterly. And both of these newspapers highlight, uplift, and bring forth the voices of our comrades behind the walls and their families. They really are the living and, unfortunately, right now dying example of what this country is about. Fascism is not on the rise. It has been here, as George Jackson said, in the 70s. Fascism is already here, whatever that looks like to you. My loved one can't speak here today because this system, which has already started from the founding slavers, they are not founding fathers. They're slavers that founded this country, have done everything that they can to uphold keeping the people silent. So any of us that want to speak out are going to be criminalized. The people that are behind the walls that are speaking out are retaliated against. We have people that are in for decades, elders, because they want to speak out. My loved one can't speak here today because he has been, they're trying to silence him. And for speaking out about exposing a COVID outbreak in the place where he is housed after spending 13 years behind the walls and coming into the reentry house owned by GEO Group, for speaking out as a journalist and as a responsible community member about an outbreak that they were trying to cover up, risking his life, his safety, the safety of the other people, and the safety of the people that he then works with when he leaves that house, that place, to go to work. They decided that they were going to take his phone and try to muzzle him and threatened to put him back in prison. So my loved one can't be here, and he's being denied home confinement. So these continued, what I am going to say, are genocidal tactics for helping people to re-enter, be with their loved ones, heal, rehabilitate. That's on us. That's all on us. We have to say this stuff is intolerable.
This concludes today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of the Pacifica sister stations and radio affiliates that contributed to the production of this show. Today's show was produced by Steve Seltzer and Polina Vasiliev. Our executive producers are Akua Holt, Polina Vasiliev, and Steve Seltzer. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. I'm Johanna Fernandez. Thanks for listening.